Welcome to Dairy Livestream. I'm your host, Corey Geiger, managing editor of Hordes Dairyman. We are broadcasting from the Cheese Cave, our studio in downtown Fort Atkinson, at the historic W.D. Hord & Sons Company building commissioned by Wisconsin Governor W.D. Hord and founder of Hordes Dairyman. Our Hot Topic Dairy Livestream is made possible thanks to the generous support from our friends at Select Sires. We thank them for their sponsorship. That hot topic conversation will focus on, could AI become illegal, and will cows become pets? For those of us on dairy farms and livestock farms, the thought of artificial insemination becoming illegal sounds like a dreadful story straight from the spooky plot lines of The Twilight Zone, a television show that once focused on bizarre science fiction plot lines. We have four great panelists, and they look forward to answering your questions in the second half of the webcast because the issue is far deeper than the title suggests. That's because those who brought forth these ballot initiatives in Colorado and Oregon have far longer-term motives. With four guests waiting in the wing, let's go straight to our first poll question. Why do fringe groups target states with direct law, and I put quotes around that, ballot initiatives? A pathway of least resistance, bypass state legislators, gain credibility in other areas, find sympathizers in non-ballot initiative states, or all of the above. So we'll go ahead and give everybody a little bit of time to answer that question. And our first guest will tell us more. So let's go ahead and close the polls. And 95% of you said all of the above. And as I said, Hannah Thompson-Wieman will share more on that poll question. Hannah joins us from the Animal Agriculture Alliance, which is a nonprofit organization that helps bridge the communication gap from farm to fork. And to say the least, today's topic needs a mighty big bridge. Prior to graduating The Ohio State University, Hannah held three internships, one with the Agra Broadcast Network, one with Select Sires, and another with Charleston Orwig. She then spent 2 years each with the Ohio's Country Journal and Farm Credit Mid-America. Since 2014, Hannah has held a number of positions with the Animal Agriculture Alliance. In January, she became the Vice President of Strategic Engagement, and one of her roles is to protect by exposing those who threaten our nation's food security with damaging information. I think we hit a bullseye on your role in our agricultural community, Hannah. Hannah, I'd submit the misinformation in Colorado and Oregon ballot initiatives are about as misguided as I've read in 26 years of journalism. What's your take?
Well, as you mentioned, I've been working on these issues at the Alliance for more than 6 years now, and it takes a lot to surprise me after 6 years very closely following activism. But I do have to say, I am really surprised to see these ballot initiatives. Now, not necessarily to see them proposed, but to have them be moving forward and something that our industry has to respond to is just, again, a new level in terms of activism. Now, animal rights activism, it's important to understand what the end game here is and why they are using ballot initiative campaigns to further that goal. Now, we are talking about activist groups and individuals who are opposed to animal agriculture merely existing. They do not believe there is any way to responsibly and ethically raise animals for food, including or using animals for any purpose, including using them for food. So for who we're talking about here, it's not about animal welfare. It's not about how the animals are raised, what we're doing, what the standards are. If at the end of the day, our industry exists, they do not believe that that is something that is acceptable, and they are working toward the goal of ending animal agriculture. The Alliance has profiles on more than 175 different organizations who are working in one way or another to oppose animal agriculture, whether that's based on issues of farm size, certain production practices, promoting veganism, or the subject at hand today, being focused on legislation. So the legislative process has been used by activist groups for decades to attempt to get bills passed that would ultimately restrict our ability to do business. These bills frequently are under the guise of animal welfare. And if you maybe don't have a lot of experience in animal agriculture, maybe you might believe that they are doing the right thing and they are helping animals or reducing animal cruelty. But that's not what it's actually about for these organizations. It's about reducing efficiency, driving up costs, and ultimately making it more difficult for farms to operate in hopes that farms will go out of business, reduce the amount of animal products that are available, again, make them more expensive for our consumer as one of their tactics to ending animal agriculture and moving people in a direction of veganism. Now, maybe you guys don't even need me because you got the poll question correct of why they are doing this in ballot initiative states versus going through state legislatures. All of the reasons listed on the poll is exactly it. Regardless of your opinion on the legislative process and elected officials, there are checks and balances in that process that do make it more difficult for activists to get these really radical proposals passed. One of those reasons being, obviously, legislators have a vested interest in listening to constituents, in understanding what issues are at play. And quite frankly, it's a smaller group for our community to try to talk to and reason with versus the end consumer out there. We all know from educational efforts, it is very difficult to reach the end consumer. They can be driven by emotion. They care a lot about animals. They maybe see cows already as pets, and they want to do anything they can to help them. So they might be more likely to vote yes on this type of initiative, especially because what actually appears on the ballot is an extremely simplified version that it would be hard pressed to vote against unless you really understand what's at play. And unfortunately, most people do not. We also typically see these initiatives pop up in states that don't have a large amount of the animal agriculture that would be impacted. For example, if you look at some of the states that have ballot initiative campaigns, Massachusetts was one where there was an initiative targeting cages for laying hens and gestation stalls for sows. There's not a lot of large-scale pork or poultry operations in Massachusetts, so there's very few to stand up. There's not a lot of enthusiasm around pushing back. Now, that's not the case here. Obviously, in Colorado and Oregon, there are very strong animal agriculture communities there who will hear about some of what they're doing later in the conversation today. So this is a bit of a departure from that usual strategy, which is try to go that path of least resistance, try to go to a state where there's not a lot of the animal agriculture community actively there to engage. But that sets the precedent. They can point to the list of states where this has been banned, and that bolsters their arguments when they go to other areas. Last thing I wanted to mention is that a lot of these ballot initiatives in recent years have also not only affected production in that state, but they've said this law applies to any products sold in this state. So you might have heard, you know, Prop 12 in California, the petition I just mentioned in Massachusetts, that not only affects producers in those states, but anyone who sells their products. That is not the case with the Colorado initiative we're talking about, but it's something else to understand about why these ballot initiatives are so relevant to you, even if they're not happening in your state.
Thank you, Hannah. You really framed the conversation very well. And then shortly, we're going to get a little deeper into it. And before we invite our next guest onto Dairy Livestream, we have another poll question. You know, I dug through and I'm like, asked myself, how many of these states allow ballot initiatives to become law if passed at the polls? And we're talking about something getting written up, it passes 51-49. So your options are 4, 14, 24, or 34 states. So go ahead and answer that poll question. And as you're doing that, I'll remind our listeners to go ahead and ask questions in our GoToWebinar control panel. Also, I'd like to thank our sponsors for today's very important discussion, our friends at Select Sires, and we'll hear a little bit from them a little later in the webcast. So, well, the correct answer here, which will be coming on the screen shortly, received 48% of the poll vote from our audience. And so 14 is the correct answer. Now, there's states above that 14 that have ballot initiatives, but some of them require review by a state legislator or the governor or different derivatives thereof. So we wanted to gain a boots on the ground perspective on this matter. So next we turn to Bill Hamrick from the Colorado Livestock Association. He's the chief executive officer and has served in that role since 2002. Bill grew up on a cattle farming operation and graduated to Colorado State University. Following graduation, he started his career with Monfort of Colorado, then Far Feeders, and then went to work for the Sparks companies. Throughout Bill's life journey, Bill gained extensive background on cattle feeding and protecting and sustaining the environment. Bill, some may say that this is a Colorado issue. However, that's far from the truth. What is going on in Colorado, and why does this issue matter to all of us?
Thank you, Corey, and good morning, everyone. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you today to give you a little more detail about what is taking place here in Colorado. Corey's already mentioned I will complete my 19th year with the Colorado Livestock Association coming up this Friday. I think one of the things that makes CLA unique from a membership point of view is that we have a multi-species organization. So we're not just about beef animals. We also have a council relative to dairy, swine, and sheep. And we're not so much about the range livestock as we are more so about the confined animals. And I think Hannah, in her presentation, kind of gave a little background in a very general way. Typically, up until this initiative has found its way into our process here, we primarily dealt with the confinement. So about sow crates, veal, and chicken cages. This initiative here is a statutory initiative, which means that at least here in Colorado, as they gather signatures for this initiative, they don't have to go anywhere in the state, but probably in the 5 or 6 county Denver metro area. Conversely, if it were to be a constitutional initiative, then they would have to get a certain percentage of signatures from the 64 counties in the state of Colorado. So a statutory initiative, at least in Colorado, is much more easily done than if it is constitutionally. This particular initiative titled Protect Animals from Unnecessary Suffering and Exploitation kind of goes by the acronym here in Colorado, at least PAWS. And it is, I think, from my standpoint, with this organization, the most onerous initiative that has ever come to light. And it truly, when it comes to livestock agriculture, is going for the jugular. So the things that it does, or at least that the proponents hope to enact, is first of all, it redefines the definition of livestock. And the one small word that creates that is they have added fish. So currently in Colorado, the livestock definition obviously covers beef and sheep and pigs, chickens, even horses for us. We don't consider them here in Colorado to be companion animals. So it's a subtle change in the definition of livestock, but certainly broadens it significantly. It redefines sexual act with an animal. And probably, according to our attorney who is representing the livestock groups here in Colorado before the Colorado Supreme Court, as that language is currently constructed, that is one of the points in our case with the justices, is that the wording in this particular change is very insightful and has certain political connotations. And I won't read the entire thing to you, but and I'm sure that some of our panelists here going forward will talk about, you know, objects and contact with genitals, et cetera. Next, it, much to the surprise or chagrin of a number of livestock people, it now defines the natural lifespan of all of the species that are covered in this redefinition of livestock. As an example, a cow, according to this initiative, her natural lifespan is 20 years. And why that is important is because further on in the initiative, it says that a cow, specifically here, or any animal for that matter, pigs or whatever, cannot be slaughtered until they have lived 1/4 of their life, or 25% of their natural lifespan. Well, obviously, we can all do the math very quickly here. That means, at least in Colorado, you could not process a cow until she had lived 5 years. Pigs and sheep, they've defined their natural lifespan as 15 years. And at least as currently constructed, the initiative does not identify the lifespan of a fish. So a bit of a curiosity there as it is currently constructed. It, and I think maybe I mentioned this a little bit previously, it redefines the handling practices, and probably more specifically about slaughter, but otherwise things that we have done for years that have been considered to be acceptable practices. And again, a couple of our panelists here are probably going to address this here as we move forward, but that would fertility testing, artificial insemination, those kinds of things, branding, hot iron branding in the case of Colorado, which is a very key part of animal identification, because we have a lot of open range here where cows and calves find a better part of their life. I think probably, Corey, that at this point at least pretty well covers what I would like to say about the initiative. I might just add that the six major livestock organizations here in Colorado, us, the Cattlemen Farm Bureau, the Wool Growers, Colorado Pork Producers Council, have all engaged legal counsel. We are currently before the Supreme Court. The initial briefs were filed the 4th of May. The answer or respondent briefs were filed the 24th of May. And we are now just waiting for the justices to take a look at that. Hopefully we will have a decision or likely sometime in the middle part of this month or the early part of July.
Thank you, Bill. And I want to reiterate for those, because most of us are dairy farmers or support the dairy industry in this dairy live stream webcast. So that law he's talking about, or not law, ballot initiative, defines a cow's age as 20 years, and they'd have to live 1/4 of their natural life before they could be harvested for food. And I can tell you firsthand that our family farm had a lot of long-lived cows. And the oldest one produced 385,000 pounds of milk. And despite that incredible production, she lived to 17 years. So obviously, they might have something backing this up. I doubt it. And so I raise that just for context for people that may not have worked with cows. And so also a number of the flaws in the Colorado ballot initiative include animal welfare issues. As I read the proposal, it would be a crime for a veterinarian to perform pregnancy diagnosis of a bovine. That's the way I read it. And for more on that, let's turn to Dr. Fred Gingrich, who is Executive Vice President of the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. As a youth, Fred worked for a number of veterinarians and was active in both 4-H and FFA. After earning his Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, Fred practiced in Visalia, California, at a large dairy practice. He then returned to Ohio, where he worked for both dairy farmers and on the beef side of cow-calf operations. Fred, can you share how a ballot initiative of this nature may impact veterinary care and could even be harmful to animals? Fred, welcome to Dairy Livestream.
Thanks, Corey. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, part of my role is telling our story as veterinarians and the industries that we serve. And you know, one of the things that I always tell people when they question the care and the welfare of the animals that we take care of is that the reason every single cattle veterinarian and cattle producer entered the business is because they like cows. And I think sometimes we just have to get down and tell people that because they sometimes that little story is missing. We truly like cows. We like the people in the industry. We like the the goals of the industry. We like producing food, but in the end, if you asked every single person that works with cattle, they like cows. And so I think we need to keep that in mind. You know, as previously stated, this bill would prohibit the entering of the genital or rectal cavity of an animal by declaring it a sex act. And so it would ban artificial insemination. It would ban diagnostic procedures such as transrectal palpation and ultrasound. And then it would also ban, of course, you know, advanced reproductive technologies like embryo transfer. You know, and I think the other thing we need to think about too, because the activist groups, they really like to play on words and really dig at the emotions of consumers and customers. And we really need to think about the, personally, I find it offensive that you would call artificial insemination or pregnancy checking cattle a sex act. And I think we also have to turn it around and say, you know, that's offensive to a person that's been a victim of a sex act, or if you're a loved one of someone who's been a victim of a sex act or a violent, you know, sexual crime, that's, you know, that damages someone for life. So comparing the two, I find just on the base, very, very offensive. You know, and I think we also need to tell the story is that there are significant advantages of these, you know, procedures such as artificial insemination. For instance, we can actually advance the welfare of cattle using these reproductive technologies like artificial insemination. For instance, if we look at the beef industry, if you look at the last NAMS, National Animal Health Monitoring Service, cow-calf survey, from about 1997, there was about 22% of beef animals were born with horns. And the last one they did in 2017, so over 20 years, they now have only 7% of beef animals are born with horns. And that has been due to the adoption of, you know, rapid genetic progress, which is done much more efficiently using artificial insemination. And so, you know, we know that there's some challenges to incorporating pole genes in the dairy industry, but we certainly can overcome those challenges using artificial insemination. I think the other thing we need to look at from a welfare perspective is, you know, the danger to animals and humans with bulls. You know, 50 years ago, 75 years ago, herd bulls were very common in the dairy industry, and now they're quite uncommon. They're utilized much more in the beef industry, of course, which is an entirely different production system where they're mostly open range situation versus confinement like dairies. And people do get injured by bulls. They get killed by bulls. I've personally known a handful of people that have been seriously injured and one person that was killed. And so, and they also can injure cows too. Bulls can. So those are other reasons we utilize artificial insemination. And then I think pregnancy diagnosis, you know, we often don't think about how does pregnancy diagnosis influence welfare? It does in both the beef and the dairy industry. So, you know, one of the reasons we utilize transrectal palpation or ultrasound isn't just a yes or no answer. It's a staging the pregnancy, right? And so when we accurately stage the pregnancy in a beef herd, our goal is to have a narrow calving window so we can manage animals as they're calving. And it's not uncommon to move animals that have not calved into a new pasture lot. That's called the Sandhills calving system. And that is a excellent way to decrease neonatal calf scours, which is the number one disease of beef calves, pre-weaned beef calves. And so if we have that staging, we can manage those animals better. And then if you look at the dairy industry, of course, every person that's familiar with the dairy industry understands that we dry those cows off when they're roughly 220 days of lactation. So you got to know when they're due to be able to dry them off appropriately, manage their nutrition in a different manner, move them to a close-up pen perhaps, manage them again with a different nutritional content, and then also anticipated calving dates so we can remove that calf and care for that calf, give it colostrum, dip the navel, tag it, et cetera, et cetera. We do all those things, but if you think about it, that's really relayed back to that pregnancy diagnosis that we do. And so, you know, I think a lot of people that aren't involved in the industry, it's up to all of us to tell that story so people can understand that this not only will not improve the welfare of animals, but it also has the potential impact of making the welfare of animals worse and people that work with them. So I think we need to really focus on those issues.
Thank you, Fred. And I you started out this, your comments with something so simple, but we forget to do it. And yesterday I did it, and we have new neighbors that came in. They bought 23 acres next door. They got one horse, a nice young couple I met first time, Jimmy and Lucy. And they looked over and they said, you know what, Corey and Krista, that's my wife, said, you have cows in the backyard. And it looks like you really like your cows. And I said, yeah, I like cows, and I worked and cared for cows all my life. And what a simple way to start a new relationship with a neighbor that has a business outside of agriculture, but has a connection with a horse. And so we have to make those conversations each and every day. So we're going to go to a poll question here before we invite Chris Wolf. And the poll question is like, going to read like this. How many species are listed in the livestock age portion of the Colorado Initiative? 1, 3, 5, or 7? So Bill talked a little bit about that, but you'd had to been listening real closely to pluck that out. So we'll go ahead. We'll remind people we got a number of very thoughtful questions coming in. Go ahead and ask those in the GoToWebinar control panel. And also, we'd like to thank Select Sires for sponsoring this important discussion today on Hordes Dairymen Dairy Livestream. So the correct answer is 7. So 29% of you got it right. A cow would be defined as living to 20 years, a pig and sheep, 15, a turkey to 10 years, a chicken, 8 years, and a duck and a rabbit, up to 6 years. Next, we're going to invite our regular contributor to Dairy Livestream, Chris Wolf. Chris, there's definitely an economic angle to this conversation. Hannah opened with a little bit of that. Aside from the language involving reproduction, the age-specific slaughter requirements would essentially send animal agriculture packing out of Colorado if this passed. As an economist, please share more.
Well, thanks, Corey. Glad to be back here again on Dairy Livestream. So let me take just a little step back. These kind of initiatives and some of these changes are things that I and some colleagues that I work with regularly have been looking at for about 15 years now, actually. So you've noticed, everybody that pays attention, right, has noticed that consumers and voters in this country are increasingly interested in the methods that are employed in food production, especially as it relates to livestock, dairy, and poultry. And as a result, commercial agriculture in this country is facing pressure to adopt changes to production practices. And these changes here are about the production process and practice itself rather than the output characteristics. You know, it doesn't relate to quality or anything of that, or food safety or things of that nature. The average American has no direct ties to commercial agriculture anymore. And most, if not, visited a commercial farm in years, if ever. And the result then is that U.S. consumers and voters, because by the way, you don't have to consume product to vote, right? Ballot initiatives are to all the registered voters. U.S. consumers and voters lack the context to understand modern production practices. And then if you couple that with the interconnectedness, communication, and publicity that's available through things like social media, you know, then you end up with a number of production practices that have been under scrutiny in different industries. And in general, you know, if you just look at a survey, if you just survey people about, you know, do you care about this issue? Do you care about that one? What you find without context and further follow through is that most people will claim to care a great deal about the production practices. But then if they're faced with a bill to pay for those practices, many do not follow through. And many of these concerns then are also then highly correlated with income. And these concerns are what an economist would call a luxury good. To avoid regulation, ag industries, all industries, but in particular agriculture in this country, you have to maintain what we would call social license, which is the acceptance of the businesses and industries' practices, you know, the public and relevant stakeholders accepting it. Without social license, then you end up regulated, monitored for compliance by laws and expectations. And keep in mind, farmers and agriculture are traditionally highly trusted and very much admired in this country. And it's something that, we want to maintain. So then the farm production practices, they end up affected through one of three different avenues, either regulation or markets or voluntary initiatives. So regulation includes legislation and the ballot initiatives like what we're talking about here today. Market then manifests itself through the retailers and processors encouraging or requiring a change, particularly for market access, which is a big deal, right? If you don't have market access, then you can't be producing, obviously. And retailers then often mandate these changes because of pressure from interested parties and to help their own corporate image and value, right? The retailers are optimizing a little bit different function than the producers are. And then the final method is when producers voluntarily adopt production practices to maintain trust. So think about the farmers assuring responsible management program. In the dairy industry, it's a real good example of something like this. When you step back and you look at consumer preferences in general, the big three things that consumers care about by far the most are food safety, quality, and price. Okay, and those overwhelm the other concerns for most everybody. There's a smaller and generally very vocal group that cares a great deal about animal welfare. Research has also shown that half of the people that vote for changes on the ballot initiative like this, like for example, the Prop 2 in California in 2008, half of the people that voted for it had not considered the economic implications of what they were voting for. They hadn't considered the fact that their food bill was going to go up. They hadn't considered the fact that this was going to change the livelihood of many people involved in agriculture and in processing and other parts of the supply chain. So it's important, you know, to consider that. Obviously, the reason these concerns are really important to farmers directly is because of the large investments that are in facilities, in livestock, in land, and in technology and related to, you know, these practices and long-term investments. You know, farmers have a lot to be concerned about here. And so obviously this requires attention. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. Now we're going to turn to our second half of the program, which is our questions from our audience here. And we're going to do that very shortly. And as a reminder, our final reminder, use the GoToWebinar control panel and type in your questions. As we're decking the questions here, we're going to hear a message from today's sponsor, Select Sires. And again, we really appreciate their sponsorship.
Healthy cows stay in the herd longer, providing a greater return on your investment. Studies show cows completing over 3 lactations generate $45 in extra profit per year. Utilize the best genetics to emphasize health traits to create more longer-living cows. Celebrate more birthdays, more lactations, and greater profits. Let Select Sires help you make longevity her legacy. To learn more, visit selectsires.com/longevity. At Select Sires, your success is our passion.
So we thank them for that very well-crafted message here, our friends at Select Sires. So we're going to go ahead and take a number of questions here. The first one here, just, Bill, I'm going to try to answer part of it here, just to give the audience some that aren't from Colorado a little bit of an idea of the livestock industry in Colorado. So while this question came in, I looked up, your part of it's going to be, tell us the rank of where the beef portion of livestock fits into Colorado. I can tell our audience that as of early this year, Colorado had 197,000 dairy cows. The milk production was up 7% over the previous year. It's a growing dairy state. It's actually a state where cows enjoy the climate because it's dry and it's cool. But what is the size and scope of some of the other livestock sectors, Bill?
We are probably around 800,000 beef animals in Colorado. This would be pretty much cows, calves, or stocker feeders. Our feedlot inventory, the confined animals on a year-over-year basis, probably would vary either side of a million head. We have about 800,000 pigs in Colorado. Just a little sidebar here. We're starting to move more away from the market hog kind of thing, and going more to gilt or sow production. Sheep are pretty steady. We are typically the largest processor of sheep in the country. And so just kind of to put that all together, Corey, If you take all of the livestock industry in Colorado, from basically the farm to the consumer, we're fundamentally about a $40 billion industry. Year to year, that will either kind of be second or third behind either tourism, technology, or oil and gas, depending on what phase those industries may be in.
Well, Bill, you have a, you're a mind reader. Another audience member wanted to know what the economic loss would be to Colorado if all of this passed and it's part of the business left. And you said $40 billion.
Yes, sir.
That's
you know, there, everybody has a piece of that pie as you move through the supply chain. I think there are a lot of factors at play here that will impact a lot of people and a lot of industries. But just as an example, we have two of the four major packers located here in Colorado. And going back to that 25% of an animal's natural age, that would mean that if you cannot process an animal in the state of Colorado until it is 5 years old, I'm talking about beef now, these two processing facilities here will not be located in Colorado. Probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 to 7,000 people will find themselves unemployed.
Fred, the next question's for you here as you talk through the animal care procedures. This one came in very early, and in reading what's being proposed in Colorado, would this initiative also eliminate any correction of this of dystocia or a hard calving or a twisted uterus, for example?
Yeah, no, my read of the bill is no, it will not, because that would be a basically veterinary procedure to treat an individual animal health event. And so we could reach into the uterus and vaginal cavity to deliver a calf or correct a malpresentation or something of that nature. But, you know, there are some other implications, which I mentioned previously. One would be another one that I didn't mention is spaying heifers. That's actually not an uncommon thing, and especially on if heifers are destined for feedlots. So that's usually done transvaginally, that and transrectally. So that would not be allowed, and then it would also ban castration of animals too, because you would be manipulating their genitals. So lots of implications there.
Chris, an economic perspective question. Would those approaches from an economic view, would those involved in investing in plant-based meats be backing to some degree the activists in order to capture market share from animal egg? Can we be that sinister in thinking that?
Well, I don't, that's a good question. I mean, certainly how you feel about something like this depends on where you sit, right? And so they don't necessarily have to be actively cheering for it to be somebody that would be not unhappy if it occurred.
Hannah, let's bring this to a national perspective. We say that Oregon has got something similar. Are there other states considering a ballot initiative of this nature?
I wanted to add a little bit to the question that was just posed to Chris. We've gotten that question a lot of, you know, who is actually behind this? And I think it's worth noting in both Colorado and Oregon, these initiatives were put forth by individuals who are self-proclaimed animal rights activists and who certainly have animal rights activist organizations. But to this point, none of the official, more formal animal rights groups have taken credit, I guess would be their wording, for these initiatives. So we certainly, you know, think they're too similar for this to be a claim.
We're having a little bit of audio problems, I think, with Hannah here. We'll give her a second. So let's go to another question here. Bill, we're going to turn this question to you. Are signatures being collected in Colorado while the proposed initiative is being considered by the state Supreme Court? So in dress rehearsal yesterday, you talked about one of the option things that you have are taking us to the Supreme Court. But if you would potentially lose there, you would this would go on the ballot in November of next year. So talk a little bit about that.
Yes. Currently, we understand that the proponents are in the process of gathering signatures. To this point, all indications are that it is on a voluntary basis and not a pay for signature process yet. If we happen to lose, and I say we, the livestock collaborators here, then the obviously the green light is on for the proponents, and they have until October the 18th of this year to gather approximately 125,000 signatures. Should we prevail, and they decide that they want to continue to press forward with this initiative, they would have to go back and primarily to the title board, not necessarily to the content of the initiative itself, and redo the title. If that should happen, any signatures that they have gathered to this point then would be null and void, and they would have to start over. And so that window for gathering signatures would have been reduced significantly from the 180 days that they had when they initially started. I think that obviously the jury is still out, no pun intended, as to what the court will decide. But we are hopeful that obviously they decide in our favor, and that perhaps if that is the case, that maybe they may decide to move on from this year. Because again, even though the activity is really taking place here in 2021, this initiative will not appear on the ballot until November of 2022.
Bill, do you know if there's any ballot initiatives in other states of this nature?
Corey, I understand that, and I think it's been mentioned here previously, there is one in Oregon. I'm not intimately familiar with what that looks like, but my understanding is that at least one aspect of that is that it would eliminate slaughter of any and all animals at all. So would have nothing to do with age or species, what have you.
You know, this is a thought-provoking question, and maybe the proponents of this just don't care. But the question came in is if the initiative would make, and we'll maybe start with Fred on this one, initiative would make artificial insemination for animals illegal, what about human beings? If a vaginal exam is illegal for animals, why not humans? Now, I don't know that we can, you know, bridge that divide there, but this is some unique territory in the way this is worded. Fred, do you want to tackle that one at all?
Yeah, I think that what the proponents of the bill would argue, so you always like to know what your opponents are arguing, and so they use the word forced breeding. So essentially what they would argue is that a human getting a prostatic exam at your doctor or a gynecologic exam at your OBGYN, that's informed consent. What their argument is that we are forcing these animals to be bred. Interestingly, in Colorado, the executive director of the Colorado Veterinary Medical Association states that that their concern is that this would also spill over into companion animals, spaying and neutering of companion animals. Proponents of the bill say that that would still be authorized because it's a health, it's for their health. We could make the same argument on cattle side too, of course, as to why we, you know, castrate them as well, dehorn them, et cetera, et cetera. So it's slippery slope and a lot of concerns there, I think.
Anyone else want to comment on that one?
So I think Fred captured that pretty good. It does say though in the first part of this that animal means any living. And they've struck dumb, but any living non-human creature, including but not limited to a dog, a cat, a horse, livestock. So even though the proponents may say to the contrary, we think, no disrespect to Fred and your interpretation, but that it gathers up dogs, cats, and horses as well.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Bill, that it does say that there. Of course, that they don't want that to be publicized because certainly, you know, their yes voters would not want the limitations put on their cats and dogs. Agreed.
Spot on. Yep.
Chris, you mentioned earlier that consumers care about food safety, quality, and price, which is not addressed in the initiative. How do we combat this initiative and educate the consumer while the activists are promoting this from an emotional standpoint? We in dress rehearsal, we actually were talking about emotional versus economic, and humans are more emotional than economic, but go ahead and answer that one.
Sure. Well, yeah, let me take a shot at that, and then Hannah can jump in and correct me. Whenever I see a survey that says, 80% of people think this or 40% of people think that, the first thing that I always think of is talk is cheap. And there's a difference between, saying that you want to do something and actually doing it, because there's hypothetical bias when you're talking about it. There's social desirability bias, which is what we call it when people get asked a question and they think answering it one way makes them look better. So they tend to do that. And so you have to adjust for things like that. Now, this is a situation with the ballot initiative where somebody's going to go into the voting booth. And so the key thing, right, is to make certain that you make the educational available to them and realize that not everybody's going to avail themselves of this education. When we have looked at these things in the past, I think understanding what the human impact is as far as what are you going to do to the livelihoods of not just the farmers, but the people that work at the processing plants, the people that work in all the support industries. Because one thing about livestock agriculture is it has a big impact all the way back to the input suppliers, the feed suppliers, the equipment dealers, all of this. And so I think, and you don't need to be hyperbolic, right? This has real impact on the economy all the way up and down the supply chain. And, to me, that's an argument that should have some weight. But, honestly, Hannah's back. Nice to see you again, Hannah.
I'm back. Luckily, I could see you guys and knew you couldn't hear me or I would still be talking off to myself. So I'll first reference the question that I was answering before GoToWebinar decided, I guess it didn't like my answer. But the Alliance does track legislative issues nationally. We don't lobby as a nonprofit, but obviously, as you've heard over the last 50 minutes, these issues are really critical to the animal agriculture community. So we do keep tabs on what's going on at the state and federal level. So we have an interactive legislative map on our website, animalagalliance.org, issues, legislation. You can visit each individual state and see what is going on there, both in terms of ballot initiative and proposed legislation. These two issues we're talking about today are the most of concern as far as ballot initiatives. There's also been one that I don't think it even has an official name yet. It's pretty early in the process in Arizona that deals more so with confinement. So as I think Bill had mentioned, that's been the traditional route these ballot initiatives have gone, is cages for laying hens, gestation stalls, and veal crates. So that one is a focus there. There are also some other pieces of legislation we've been following that deal with farm size. So Iowa, Rhode Island, and Oregon each had proposed pieces of legislation that would put a moratorium on farms of a certain size, referred to as factory farm bans by some of their proponents. And then additionally, we've also seen several pop up that are also in the vein of confinement, but that are going through the legislative process versus ballot initiative. It's kind of calming down now. The beginning of this year was hot and heavy with a lot of state legislatures being in session. Winter time is usually when we see a lot of these. There's also a belief among some activist groups that the new administration is going to be more favorable toward their viewpoints, mostly because of the interest in climate. So we think that's why we're seeing so much legislative activity, is because they think they are going to get farther because they can claim that their initiatives are aligned with the priorities of the new administration. So to the topic of emotion, we absolutely need to recognize that these groups are trying to drive an emotional appeal to voters. They want to liken animal agriculture, cows, sheep, pigs, to pets. Most people are pet owners. People love their pets. In some surveys, people have said they would save a dog that was about to get hit by a car before they would save a stranger. So they're trying to make a connection with animals that people really care about and say, you know, you wouldn't want this to happen to your dog or cat, so why would you accept it in animal agriculture? So that's the kind of thing we need to be responding to and talking about, the fact that there are professionals like Fred's organization that are here to care for animals in addition to farmers and ranchers that are dedicated to them. And I think in addition to the points that Chris made about the economic impact and the impact on people if this were to pass, is the sustainability impact. How much more inefficient is it to raise animals in the way that this bill would dictate? And what would that impact have? How much more land would we use? How much less meat would we have in order to meet the demand? Last year was one of the first times that people in my generation went to the grocery store and saw empty shelves. So that is something that we can be talking about, of what is the impact on food affordability, security, and accessibility of this type of issue passing. So I think I took up all the time that I missed there. So thank you for indulging me.
Very good. We're going to go to speed round here because we got about 8 questions. We got 9 minutes left. An audience member from Oregon says the Oregon ballot initiative varies a bit from Colorado, as it would outlaw hunting, fishing, and control of rodents. Any 30-second comment there? Hannah's nodding her head. Go ahead.
I think something else that's interesting in Oregon, and I'm not sure if it's the same in Colorado, but as I was refreshing my memory on Oregon, is that it makes, or any certain misdemeanor, if it's committed in front of a child, becomes a felony. So if that were to pass, then any kind of 4-H, FFA demonstration, educational activity that involved AI in front of children would make you a felon.
That's very disheartening. Bill, any thoughts why Colorado was the lucky state chosen to have to deal with this initiative?
I think we have a history of initiatives here in Colorado, and prior to us changing the process here, and I think I mentioned this early on, you know, we now, if it's constitutional, you got to go to every county in Colorado. But I think today we still have a fairly liberal initiative process. There are other states that are much more onerous than we are. And so I think it's kind of that low-hanging fruit thing. Let's go to Colorado. We can go to the zoo, we can go to the Pearl Street Mall, and in a relatively speaking short period of time, have the necessary signatures and move forward.
Chris, you watch a lot of things nationally. If we beat this ballot initiative, and I use the word beat, and it goes down in defeat either at the Supreme Court or at the polling place, can we expect it to show up yours later down the road? The short answer is probably some derivative.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the activist groups that care about this stuff have a strategy of picking states and also intentionally change things a little bit each time, because they're trying to create a quilt work to make it more difficult to have these type of industries. And it's definitely, you know, they probably learn a lesson and try something else.
Hannah, I'm going to send the next question to you here. This one came in before the webcast. The person asked it, and it's a very thoughtful question. It's a little long, so bear with me. I hear the animal rights groups always bringing up this argument about AI versus rape. We know this is ridiculous. Do you think the animal rights group are using this argument to target milk buyers, particularly women, to make them feel complicit in the abuse of animals by purchasing dairy? I think the terms they use are very disturbing, and they realize if messaging is done correctly, they may have an impact.
I think the short answer is yes, absolutely. They are trying to, again, draw off of those emotions. Most times it is women, it is mothers who are making the food purchasing decision for their family. So they are trying to draw parallels and make you have that kind of visceral reaction. Similarly, we also saw, with all the discussion about immigration and children being separated from their parents at the border, we saw activist groups say, how can you be upset about that when cows are separated from their calves every day in order to get you the milk that you're drinking? So those are exactly the kind of situations that they will look to exploit and kind of have people have that very emotional reaction. I want to echo some of what Fred said earlier. I do think that is deeply offensive to humans, women who have experienced sexual assaults and who are survivors of that type of abuse. And quite frankly, I think that's the kind of messaging we should hope for activist groups to continue to use, because most people do see right through that. Similarly, with when they claim that it's a Holocaust and they try to draw those kind of parallels, that does tend to get pushback from reasonable people who do see that as offensive to human beings who have suffered those type of incidents. So, you know, again, I think that's the kind of messaging that if they do continue using, it just erodes them as being seen as reasonable by the average consumer.
Fred, you're a veterinarian, and I think there's dairy farmers in the audience that feel the same as this person, and I'm going to send this question to you. In the dairy industry, some producers may have felt that we lost ground when tail docking was required to end. How can the dairy industry best prepare for future legislation and that we do not continue to lose ground?
I think we need to continue. So as a veterinary association, we're a science-based organization. And so for me, I was, for our organization, I believe it was 1995 that we stated that that there was no scientific evidence that routine tail docking benefited the cow. And so for that, we were speaking for the cow. One of our members used to always say, "Who will speak for the cow?" So I think it's veterinarians and dairy farmers. So I think that these two things are entirely different subjects. You know, I previously outlined the benefits of all the things that this would ban that help the cow. And so if we continue to speak for the cow, we'll have credibility within our own profession as well as with consumers.
Speaking for the cow is a very important part here. We're going to bundle these last two questions into one. We're going to start with Bill, and I'm going to read them both here. And I think they're really similar. Has Colorado conducted polling on this question? If so, what's the results? And the second part is, what's the likelihood of this initiative going through? Bill, you're in Colorado. Do you want to take a stab at that one?
Sure. Is that kind of a two-part question?
Yes. Go ahead.
First of all, we have not done any polling or focus groups. Obviously, our resources are very precious. And so once the Supreme Court renders it decision, then we will proceed. We obviously are going to enlist some professional help in that regard. And Corey, tell me again, second question.
If you would happen to lose your battle at the Supreme Court level, what's your take on this this initiative actually passing?
Okay, I'm going to kind of tie it back to the focus group polling kind of thing. Just in a very informal kind of setting, we have been contacted, and I say we, not just CLA, but the other entities here involved, by a number of non-ag organizations, businesses, entities, okay, who are adamantly opposed to this initiative. And it kind of goes back to some of the things that Chris had mentioned earlier. This is not just about cows and pigs in Colorado. There is a huge economic ripple effect here that it's going to, especially our rural counties here in Colorado, it's going to be devastating. So there are now a majority of the county commissioners in Colorado who have come out officially opposed to it. So that is not formal polling by any means, Corey, but I think our sense is today, if we as the livestock industry go about this in the right way, we've got a chance, if we're not successful at the Supreme Court, to be successful at the ballot box.
And hasn't the governor, whose spouse is vegan, even come out against us, Bill? Is that right?
I have not seen that, okay? I'm not saying, Hannah, that he hasn't. Our attorney general is on the record through a Twitter feed that he is adamantly opposed to it and will fight against it. Our governor has even indicated that will not be good for Colorado. So not an official position, if you will, If the first gentleman has taken a position, I apologize, I've not seen it.
I meant the governor.
Okay, yeah. Governor, probably not as strong as our attorney general, but certainly didn't say I like this.
Well, this wraps up our dairy live stream webcast. Well, could AI become illegal and will cows become pets? And I would say, Bill, beyond a ripple effect, I would call it a catastrophic snowslide down the Rocky Mountain Range should this get passed. And it's important that those other counties, probably you said there were 64 in Colorado, if 59 of them are rural and depend on rural economics, those are other partners. Our next dairy live stream will air on Wednesday, June 30th, and it'll, like this episode, will be archived the very next day on our Hordes Dairyman YouTube and podcast channels. We look forward to seeing you then. On behalf of Hannah Thompson-Wieman, Bill Hamrick, Fred Gingrich, Chris Wolf, and our sponsor, Select Sires, I am Corey Geiger, your host, and thank you for joining us today. We wish you all a good day. Goodbye, everyone.